Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable today is Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Julie.
Good morning, Amy.
Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Laura.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Noah Blundo, executive editor at Hannah News Service. Welcome back, Noah.
Good morning.
President Trump, in a White House address Saturday night, described the U.S. mission that resulted in the world's most powerful bombs being dropped on three sites in Iran.
Tonight, I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated. Iran, the bully of the Middle East, must now make peace. If they do not, future attacks will be far greater and a lot easier.
Administration officials have framed it as a limited attack, and Vice President J.D. Vance has called it a war with Iran's nuclear program, not a war with Iran. Democrats in Congress, along with some Republican members, have raised questions about the unilateral attacks being carried out without consulting Congress. So, Laura, what has the reaction been like closer to home? What have we been hearing about the events from over the weekend from Ohio lawmakers?
Well, both U.S. Senators John Houston and Bernie Moreno, who are Republicans, support it. Interestingly, Thomas Massey of Northern Kentucky and Warren Davidson from over in the north of Dayton area are opposed to it. Greg Landsman from Cincinnati is in favor of it. So it's interesting. It's one of these issues that it seems to be cutting across political lines.
Yeah, and Julie, what do you make of whether or not congressional approval was needed and where some Republican members of Congress are coming down on that, where they're saying they support the president, but maybe he should have asked us?
Right. Well, I mean, since the beginning of this Trump term, we've seen Trump sort of go around not only traditional but legal barriers that are in place that are supposed to allow Congress to give up or down thumbs ups on different things, like over federal agencies and things like that that they create. And so in this case, like I'm not the expert on whether this was needed, but generally speaking, we go to the Congress for acts of war. So it's really intriguing to me that the vice president has said this really isn't a war action. This is against a nuclear program and not against a country.
Yeah. And Noah, what's your take on what we've seen from Senator Bernie Moreno and Senator John Husted on Senator Husted said Iran's stated goal is death to America, and it has been its intent to develop nuclear weapons. The weapons could pose an unacceptable threat to America and our allies. What do you make of, Husted's comments on this?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be in line with a lot of what other people are saying, which is, you know, leading with the idea that, you know, Iran having a nuclear weapon is the focus. Not having a nuclear weapon is the focus. There's, you know, a lot of these also have praise for the military for carrying it out successfully. Nobody is really, you know, rah-rahing for like an actual war.
Yeah. We have to understand, too, that, I mean, this is really important for Trump because Trump kind of built his coalition that elected him to a second term on this, not exactly anti-war, but obviously on a make America great again, America first. And, you know, I'm not going to get us into forever wars. There were a lot of his supporters, including, you know, Tucker Carlson, Charlie Kirk, and really important, influential MAGA folks who were just like, we don't want that, and Trump is on our side. So he's kind of throwing some of his base for a loop on this. And so you see in these statements a very, you know, measured way of walking that line, I think, by our senators.
And as of late in the day on Sunday, Governor Mike DeWine had not posted any comments on social media about Iran. Do you feel like that's unusual, or do you think he'll address it when asked, I guess?
Oh, he's, I think he has a public event later today, and I'm sure that the State House Press Corps will be there to ask for his reaction.
Well, we can leave it there for now, but on tomorrow's Tech Tuesday show, which is tomorrow at 11, I'll be talking with Robin Wright, a foreign affairs analyst who has written several books on the Middle East, including Rock, the Kashba, Rage and Rebellion Against the Islamic World. So we're going to be talking about some of the technology used in the operation. You can listen to Tech Tuesday tomorrow on All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. And this is All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable. And with me today, Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, Noah Blundo with Hannah News Service, and Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press. So let's turn our attention now to state issues and the looming deadline to pass the multi-billion dollar biennial state budget. An income tax cut, property tax relief, child tax credits. There's a lot in there, but let's do a quick overview of some of the key elements. The House and Senate and the governor all are taking different paths when it comes to tax relief. The most recent idea is to flatten the income tax to 2.75%. This represents a tax cut for Ohioans making more than $100,000. It was overwhelmingly passed by the Senate. The rumor is House members seem to like the idea, but Governor DeWine, this was not a part of his plan. Julie, what do you make of the flat tax and whether it's going to make it through to the final budget?
Yeah, I mean, obviously anything related to taxes has to do with how much it cuts from certain programs. Mm-hmm. And I think that DeWine has sort of been silent because he's trying to figure out, you know, whether such a cut would be both politically and policy-wise, a good idea for the programs he cares about. So, because it's pretty deep, but it is really directed toward those of higher incomes. And so, you know, is that a good look for them, particularly in a budget where they're giving a lot of money to the Cleveland Brown Stadium and other things? And, you know, whether that relief is going to go to the areas that he cares about.
And Noah, he didn't propose an income tax cut whenever he put forth his budget. And he also said, when asked about it, he said no company has ever told him that they don't come to Ohio because the income tax rate is too high.
Yeah, he says this repeatedly. His budgets generally haven't focused on income tax cuts like the prior governor, John Kasich, has. He's laid out his priorities, but he's also signed multiple budgets, final versions that have had income tax cuts. He's advocating mostly for his child tax credit proposal. But he, you know, he says he doesn't think it's really that necessary to make Ohio competitive for business attraction.
Yeah. And over the years, Ohio has like collapsed out a lot of the tax brackets. I think there used to be like five or six of them, and now we're down to two.
It was nine at one point. Nine.
Yeah. So we flattened the tax, just not completely. So we think he has the ability to veto it, but that would kind of torpedo the whole budget if he vetoed that part, right?
Right. I mean, because you build the
budget on the income, yeah.
Right, on the revenue side, so.
The House has also been a little more, they didn't put this in. They didn't put any income tax cut changes to my recollection. And they're not necessarily opposed, but there have been comments as well. Do we need to flatten it? Do we need to go all the way down to one bracket at this time, given the cost, given the other priorities? Because they also want to deal with property taxes, which could have a price tag too.
Well, Governor DeWine says he does, as Noah mentioned, he favors his proposal to give a $1,000 tax credit to working parents with young children. Here's what he said about that.
That's the only tax cut I'm in favor of. That tax cut makes sense, and it's what we should do, and I hope the legislature, as we go through this process, will look at that.
So that tax credit was stripped from the House budget. House Speaker Matt Huffman said there was no interest among lawmakers to raise taxes for anyone this budget cycle, and the child tax credit would have been funded by a hike in cigarette taxes.
I also don't think that $1,000 is necessarily going to change the lifestyle.
So what kind of relief for young families does the House and Senate support? Like, if the House doesn't want the tax credit, do you think the Senate will? The Senate didn't have it in there, right, Noah? Right?
Yeah. No, they didn't. No, they've not really shown any interest. And part of it is the financing mechanism there. Governor DeWine had multiple quote-unquote sin tax increases in his budget. He wanted to hike the cigarette tax for the child tax credit. He wanted to increase taxes on marijuana. He wanted to increase taxes on sports gambling. That was his stadium financing proposal, and all of those, you know, as the speaker said, they're not interested in raising any taxes, even if they are offsetting those increases with cuts or credits elsewhere.
We have to remember this is Mike DeWine's last budget. Children is really his legacy that he's going for. You know, he's been in politics really his whole life. That has been a focus of him, of his administration, is to help kids to be able to have this laundry list of things that have been done, including creating a whole department for that and helping with schools and reading, getting the science of reading passed last budget. And so I think that for him, you know, it is maybe a small amount, as Huffman says, but it's important to what he's trying to say about the state and his priorities.
Also, $1,000 tax credit does make a difference for a lot of people who are on a tight budget.
It's refundable. A lot of times the state creates credits and that are not refundable, but this is. So if it wipes out your tax liability, you know, you get the difference. In your refund. It's not just...
Groundwork Ohio is an early childhood advocacy group, and it rallied dozens of supporters at the State House last week in favor of the governor's tax credit plan. Linan Gutierrez disagreed with Huffman's assessment that it would not amount to any meaningful relief. She told the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau that a couple making $46,000 a year with two kids under the age of six would consider it helpful.
That's $2,000 back on their taxes. That's an increase in their overall income of 4%. And that translates to rent, a couple months of groceries.
Yeah. So, Noah, if in conference committee the House and Senate decide to put this back in there, can they find the money to pay for it without the cigarette tax?
Oh, they can always find money for anything if they really put their minds to it. It's just a matter of if it's a... You know, the governor is in there in the conference committee negotiations because he does have the veto pen. But when you start to get into vetoing the tax structure, you've essentially blown up the budget and perhaps imbalanced it. So really, they want to, I mean, he will certainly veto some things in the end, but they want to hash as much out beforehand as they can.
What do you think of this conference committee? I mean, they're going to spend several days this week trying to work this out, whether they're going to flatten the income tax, how they're going to pay for it. How does this compare to past year's budget? Is it the same old, or do you feel like this one is different?
I feel like there's some fundamental differences heading into conference that are, you know, really, as we're saying, about the big ticket items of how we're going to raise the money and spend the money. And oftentimes it's over some small thing, like, say, if you want to consider the Cleveland Browns a very niche thing, you know, it might be whether we leave that in or we take that out or how we fund it. But, you know, to have like these things on the table, I don't know. Laura, what do you think?
I mean, I think a lot of it is same old, but you're right. I think the Browns, how to fund the Browns Stadium is sort of, it illustrates how they're really far apart. The governor wants to raise the sports betting tax. The House wants to issue bonds to pay for this. And then the Senate wants to use unclaimed funds. And so I think that's a big point of contention that they're going to have to work out.
Yeah, to have three solidly very different plans, that seems like that everyone's very far apart.
But in conference committee, you know, a lot of it is horse trading. So, you know, they'll give the Senate what they want here and the House gets something that they want there. And, you know.
That's typically why when you see the Senate version of the budget come out, they just wipe out all the House earmarks so that they can be traded back.
Right.
Little by little.
This is all strategic. But this is very like in the room where it happens.
Yeah,
kind of
what's,
thing. Yeah.
What's different for me is that there's less going on elsewhere. Usually the week before they leave for summer break, everyone else is running around like maniacs because this is our last chance to get any action on other bills that are out there, hundreds of them, for months. But they've really buckled down and focused on this alone. There's very little else going on except for the marijuana bill. There's very little else going on at the State House besides budget conference.
Right, and sometimes whole bills like that would be part of the negotiating week of the budget, which would be like, okay, well, we'll pass your this bill if you put this in the budget, you know, because they're trying to get votes, and they love it if a budget can pass unanimously, which I know the Democrats in the Senate unified against it, which is quite rare. Because obviously there are always sort of things you hold your nose at in a budget, but generally there's plenty of positive that you can support. Mm-hmm. But that whole caucus is trying to take a stand in our age of, you know, political polarization.
Is the goal to look united? Do they, are they trying to avoid having Governor DeWine veto anything, or do they not care?
I just think that they want to go back to their districts and be able to say, mm-hmm. like, they supported the main, mm-hmm. the main major policies of their legislative session.
I meant to look up. I can't even remember if 2 years ago DeWine vetoed anything in the budget. Do you remember?
Well, you know, in a budget bill, because there's appropriations, obviously, yeah. the governor has the line item veto mm-hmm. ability. It's not an up or down veto. So you can go in there and just erase, you know, this piece or that piece. Mm-hmm. And typically, you know, usually there's more than a dozen little vetoes here and there that the governor will do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. a big one in not so recent history was that Governor Kasich had vetoed attempts to wipe out the Medicaid expansion, mm. and then they overrode him, right? Do I have that backwards?
DeWine has been overridden on a couple of vetoes. There was one on flavored tobacco sales, I think.
Oh, yeah.
They overrode him on that, and there was another one that is escaping me at the moment.
Well, we will see what happens. Coming up on the Reporter Roundtable, we're going to talk about a few other big issues that are still up in the air until the budget passes, mainly school funding, property taxes, and we can circle back around to the Browns' new stadium. That's when All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Public Radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With me today, Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Noah Blundo, executive editor at Hanna News Service. So back to the budget a little bit. The big portion of the budget involves school funding, and that also relates to property taxes. School treasurers in Central Ohio oppose lawmakers' property tax relief plan, saying that it could be a financial disaster. And this proposal would limit how much cash schools can have in reserve and require the rest of it to be returned to property owners if they have too much cash in reserve. Under the Senate's version, counties could reduce property taxes if districts carry over more than 50% of their previous year's budget. That threshold is higher than what the House had. The House had proposed 30%. There's also a stipulation that districts cannot propose levies if they have a carryover balance that exceeds 100%. So, Julie, in the history of public school funding in Ohio, I mean, it's a troubled history. It's a confusing history. What would a compromise look like this time?
Well, thank you for throwing that one at me. Yeah, that is a really tough question to answer. Mm-hmm. I think maybe portions of or different percentages of mm-hmm. some of the same things. Like,
yeah.
For example, I know that the houses have been in disagreement over what percentage of your carryover balance you can have before you get a restriction. Mm-hmm. And that's because some school districts have come forward and said, you know, we're doing this. It's a responsible thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I think from the state legislators' point of view, they're seeing this pile of money cumulatively, not in one place, but across the board when you add it up, and saying, oh, gosh, we're having, you know, to balance a budget, and the school districts have all this money. We can't forget that this is at a time when the Republican legislature in general is kind of down on public schools and funding universal vouchers that apply to religious schools and private schools, and taking issue with teachers' unions and things like that. So it's a huge debate anyway.
And Noah, the finance chair in the Senate, Jerry Serino, basically told school districts that they should be happy with what he came up with in the Senate because it's the best they're going to get.
I think he said it can only get worse for you. I read the story that Cleveland.com wrote about that. I mean, he defended himself later. I don't know if that was just his persuasive argument of we did better for you than the House did, so you ought to get on the team with us. This is, I think, you've got multiple factors. You've got, you know, the school funding is always like one of the top three issues in the budget. But then you've got a slightly tighter budget than you've had in past cycles, and you have this property tax problem that all the legislators say is the number one issue from their constituents. So that, I think, is all swirling together. And also, you know, this carryover cap and the empowerment of county budget commissions to reduce rates is a way for the state to provide property tax relief without footing the bill. Because if you do something like, you know, there's a homestead exemption, but the state is reimbursing local governments for that. People have talked about a circuit breaker where you would get some kind of tax credit if your property taxes exceed a certain percentage of your income. The state would be picking up the tab for that. So this carryover cap and county budget commission language is a way for them to provide property tax relief without having the state pay directly for it.
What's a circuit breaker? I don't know what that means.
It's something that has been debated in the last year or two as they've talked about ways to provide property tax relief, where it says if property taxes exceed X percentage of your income, 5%, 7%, something like that, a circuit breaker trips your property taxes. Well, they don't decrease your property taxes, but what they do is they give you an income tax credit to kind of offset it. They can't. Mm. There is constitutional language about the uniformity of tax rates that I couldn't begin to understand, but they can't go in adjusting individual people's tax rates. That would be a problem.
Property taxes are so complicated, and it's not just school funding. I mean, there's a lot going on in the budget with the ideas of property taxes and going on outside of the budget.
Thinking more about your question on the compromise, I mean, one compromise would be to not put any of this in this particular budget and to pass the two bills that are moving through that have been backed by this sort of influential coalition of business groups that, you know, they're trying to rewrite a law that's been on the books for since the 1970s and upgraded. And it feels a little clumsy to me to sort of try to do both those in the same session and get ahead of those changes in the budget while those bills are out there.
Not to mention, isn't there a constitutional amendment that someone's trying to propose to eliminate property taxes altogether?
I don't think they're going to make it to the ballot this cycle.
But the threat is there. They're saying, do something, right?
The specter of it is definitely coming up at the State House a lot to say, we have to do something. Otherwise, this catastrophic, you know, sword of Damocles is the cliche that has come up a lot in the State House hearings.
Right. I mean, those ballot issues always are a motivator for the lawmakers
to try to do something before it gets there. Yeah.
You know, in their view, a lot of times these are a little clunkier than what they could do with some deliberation. And so, why don't we write it in some kind of manner that we all have control over rather than have the citizens bring it forward?
Yeah, and actually I think a lot of issues the legislature has preferred not to deal with have been pushed through the ballot.
Well, Laura mentioned it earlier. Another thing that is still up in the air with the budget, with three different versions, is stadium funding. And call it a full court press, to use a sports pun, but the owners of several major sports franchises, the Columbus Blue Jackets, the Cincinnati Reds, Cleveland Cavaliers, the Cleveland Guardians. They all want state funding for future stadium projects. So in a letter signed by many of them, they're calling on Governor DeWine and House Speaker Matt Huffman and the Senate President Rob McCauley to move forward with plans to use unclaimed funds for future stadium projects. Do you find it unusual for the amount of pressure exerted by team owners who are all saying, yes, we want this money from the state? Noah, what do you think?
I think that there is a kind of, I mean, the Senate has proposed a pretty broad pool of funding. There's the $600 million for the Browns, but they're talking about taking $1.7 billion in unclaimed funds and setting it aside in this pool for these kind of projects. And what everyone has been trying to get away from is these one-offs where one cycle the Browns are there, and then the Bengals are there, and then the Blue Jackets are there, and then the Crew is there, and then the Cavs and the Guardians and the Reds and maybe the minor league teams. So I think it's very attractive to them to say, hey, we're going to have this big pool of money. It doesn't involve increasing taxes like DeWine's idea did. And so I can, it doesn't surprise me that they're all getting behind it.
I can think, though, there are a lot of other things that those unclaimed funds could pay for. Like, I don't know, schools, property tax relief, housing.
The owners of these sports teams, they're just like licking their chops at the idea that they could have a sustained pool of funding for these big projects. I know that like the Bengals stadium want a bunch of upgrades to their stadium, and it's a little bit ironic that people who forgot about their security deposit with their landlord or their utility are going to end up funding a stadium for multi-million-dollar athletes to play in, owned by billionaires.
Yeah, and I was talking with some friends about this issue over the weekend, and we were all lamenting how difficult it is to get, like, if your parents' estate has a $20 or $100 in there or whatever. I mean, the amount of hoops you have to go through and paperwork and affidavits and,
you have to, like, reopen the estate,
And I mean, other people don't know. I think that those who are alive and kicking and have taken a look and can get it have kind of come forward now and said, wait, what? even though they do publish it extensively, I think once a year, the whole list. So it's interesting that once the Browns came through and made this huge argument, I mean, they made their very best argument for why a new stadium was going to be fantastic for Brook Park, not so much for Cleveland, and why it was necessary and how it was going to make life better, then it really kind of puts the lawmakers in a bind, because if you're like, okay, this is our economic development engine and we're going to fund you, but we're not going to fund anybody else.
So do you think this unclaimed funds plan will remain in there? I mean, not that you all can predict the future, but of the three plans, it seems the one that has had the least pushback?
I think it is the easiest path for the lawmakers to take. It's kind of quote unquote free money. They don't have to tax anybody. They don't have to issue any debt service. They're talking about only using the oldest unclaimed funds on the argument that they're the least likely to be claimed. And they have, I think the Senate has a process whereby additional money would go into this pool once it hit that 10-year mark. So
constantly funds would be circulating in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But isn't it also the case that the state is not out, it can't forgive itself of its obligation? So if you come forward and say, I have unclaimed funds, they still have to pay them.
I believe, yeah. That's there's some legal questions there that I don't want to play lawyer on the radio.
So that might be why they're going after the older ones, because it's like, clearly if somebody wanted these,
they would have
gotten them a long time ago.
Or it's complicated to get them if the person's not alive anymore.
Yeah, I looked up my profile after this came out, it was just a matter of, can I find the documentation of when I lived at this address 15 years ago?
How much are you owed?
Oh, maybe a total of $75 or something like that. So,
Is that worth it to you?
I don't know if I could find some old utility bills or something, but that was in the paper days, and I think I've purged all those. So,
All right. Well, this is All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. And today with me in the studio, we have Noah Blundo with Hannah News Service, Laura Bischoff with the Columbus Dispatch, and Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press. Immigration is a topic that is playing out every day at a national level as the Trump administration works to meet its deportation goals. And Noah, Senate Republicans last week passed a bill that would prevent local officials from blocking immigration enforcement. Can you tell me more about what this bill would do?
Yeah, so Senator Christina Rogner from Summit County proposed this bill. It's actually inspired by Franklin County. There, some of the common pleas judges put in a rule that basically said, don't come arrest people on immigration charges at the courthouse unless you have a warrant or you get our okay. Mm-hmm. She objected to that. Nobody basically said if you're here illegally, you should not be free from arrest. A lot of the people who objected to it, say, hey, because there's also, it says that you can't be privileged from arrest for unlawful presence in the U.S. or suspicion thereof. So people raise concerns about, about due process. What constitutes reasonable suspicion? You can get arrested. And they made the argument that you're going to discourage people from showing up to court, right? Mm-hmm. You want people, even if they've done something wrong, you want them to participate in the court process rather than be fugitives from justice. And people just aren't going to show up to their court dates if they think they're going to get nabbed.
So this was something in the Senate. Is there a House version or is it just a standalone, its own thing?
I don't recall if there is a House companion, but it hasn't gotten as much traction, hasn't moved as quickly if there is. So I don't imagine that it will pass before the summer break. So this debate will probably rev back up in the fall.
I think one advantage that law enforcement sees to making arrests in courthouses is that people have already been scanned and they are not weapon. They're not carrying weapons. So it makes it a little bit easier.
But I don't think it only applies to courthouses either. I mean, certainly we're seeing all over the country people arrested at Home Depots and at concerts and at on farms and in workplaces. And so it seems to me that this dovetails with sort of sanctuary city protections.
Mm-hmm. It just happened to be inspired by that one rule. I don't know what the broader applications are.
Now, the governor has said that he supports the deportation of immigrants who have committed, quote, significant crimes, but that deporting children who immigrated to the United States when they're young is a different matter. And then he also said that he's concerned about Haitian immigrants in Springfield. They're bracing for their temporary protected status to be revoked in August. And the governor is worried that widespread deportations will deplete the local workforce in Springfield. So the governor's kind of on both sides of this issue here. Would you say that, Noah?
He's said repeatedly just, if you want to come here to work and raise your family, we welcome you. I mean, he prefaces that by saying legal immigration, but
The Haitians in Springfield and elsewhere in Ohio came under this temporary protected status program. They came legally and established their homes and their lives here and are an important part of the workforce in Springfield. And I think that Governor DeWine, because he has long supported the Becky DeWine School in Haiti, named after his daughter, and he's made multiple trips down there, he has a deep knowledge of the conditions in that country and why somebody would need to flee.
Yeah, but I do think that the Trump administration has, and particularly the Vice President, J.D. Vance, has talked about how all along when they became critical of Springfield during the campaign, that they don't view TPS as legal. They think that it is was illegally extended by the Biden administration. And so they're kind of casting all the people who came here under that program as still illegal, even though they were legal under the law of that day.
Yeah. Would you see Governor DeWine blocking something from the Trump administration. You know, if they if there actually is a move to move into Springfield, and I don't know if Governor DeWine would go that far. I don't know.
Yeah. We are a home rule state in the sense of the National Guard. So mm-hmm. I think that he gets to decide what our National Guard does. But yeah. That would be a big thing.
That would be extreme. Yeah, I don't know.
He does not relish getting into public disagreements with the president. I'll say that.
Well, before we take a break, I also wanted to touch on the names of five Ohio members of Congress were on the list that a man accused of killing one Minnesota lawmaker and injuring another. Police were calling the shootings politically motivated because the shooting victims were Democrats, and so were all the names on the list. There were several Ohio lawmakers on this list. Laura, do we know any more about, you know, the Ohio lawmakers who were on the list?
I think that they were notified shortly after the shootings became apparent, and they were provided extra security patrols from the State Highway Patrol and or their local law enforcement. Allison Russo spoke about this on the House floor last week and just was grateful for the assistance. And, you know, it is, I was sort of thinking about this, how, as she was speaking, how our colleagues in Minnesota must be feeling, because, mm-hmm. you know, to have like a member of your General Assembly gunned down and somebody else shot at and others hunted, mm-hmm. I mean, that is just an extraordinary, crazy story. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be difficult to cover.
Yeah. And I, you know, there were a lot of Democrats' names on the list, you know, Joyce Beatty, Marcy Kaptur, Amelia Sykes. It basically seemed like eventually all the Democrats' names were on the list. I don't know.
Right. Greg Landsman was on there as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that early on that it suggested that it wasn't necessarily the party label and it had something to do with abortion rights and their positions on abortion. But, you know, it's a developing story.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the implementation of the controversial higher education law that goes into effect on Friday. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
It's summer fun for everyone. Join WOSU at family community events and festivals all summer long. Have your picture taken with beloved PBS characters, do a craft, show your WOSU spirit, and win prizes. For all dates and locations, visit our events page, wosu.org/events. We can't wait to meet you.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. With me in the studio, Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and Noah Blundo, executive editor at Hannah News Service. Laura, I wanted to talk about the dangerous dog law. The Ohio House voted unanimously in favor of a bill that would strengthen the state's dangerous dog laws. It's a topic you wrote about as a part of an investigative series. The bill is named Avery's Law, written for 12-year-old Avery Russell, who was seriously disfigured and injured following an attack by two pit bulls. You profiled her story earlier this year, and it caught lawmakers' attention. Can you walk us through this law about dangerous dogs and what would change if it passes?
Well, it would stiffen the penalties. It would require if you have a dangerous or vicious dog that you get at least $100,000 in liability insurance. A dangerous dog is one that attacks someone and breaks the skin in a bite. A vicious dog would be one that carries out serious injury or even kills someone. And under this bill, if a dog commits a vicious act, like what happened to Avery, it would euthanasia would be required, or if it kills a person, it would be required, not optional. And then there's also a little provision in there that would say that if you have a dangerous dog at home and you have somebody who's invited to your property, you would be required to secure the dog so that it doesn't come in contact with your invitee. And that is specifically what happened to Avery. She was on a play date. Mom and kid, they went over to the cousin's house, and the attack happened at the cousin's house. The cousin did not secure the dogs. It's something that would have taken 30 seconds, and instead Avery's life is forever altered.
Now, you don't see many unanimous votes these days, but it was 97-0, right?
Yeah, 97 zip.
So is there a companion bill? Is this moving forward? What happens next?
So there's a companion bill in the Senate that Bill Blessing is sponsoring that's already had its first hearing. There was a lot of changes in the House bill, but they're going to – Bill Blessing said he's committed to just picking up what Kevin Miller's bill says. And so Blessing said he hopes to have it done by the end of the year.
The in the House, there, in addition to Kevin Miller's bill, there were a few others – and they kind of, you know,
they merged them all
the best of all worlds. And they were talking about making it into one big, beautiful bill, because everybody likes to make that joke these days in the House committee. So that's part of how and they added Meredith Lawson Roe, a Democrat from Reynoldsburg. They added her as the joint sponsor of Kevin Miller's bill. I think on the floor they amended the title of the bill to put her name on there as sort of as a show of the broad support for it.
Lawmakers tried to strengthen the dog laws back in 2014 after a fatal attack of a woman in Dayton, but that effort stalled. So what's different this time around?
I think, partially because we shined a big light on what was going on and showed that these were lives that were completely altered, or even in the case of the woman in Pickaway County, the 73-year-old Joanne Eichelbarger, who was killed by her neighbor's dogs. And the dogs had a dangerous history of biting another neighbor and a killing her dog, and nothing was done. The dogs weren't seized. There's a lot of confusion. The current dog law is very messy. It's difficult to understand, and county by county, each dog warden kind of approaches things a little bit differently. So like in Licking County, the dog wardens, they wear police vests, they carry guns, they effectuate arrests, they do everything they can under the dog law. But over in Franklin County, the dog wardens, they wear vests, but they don't carry any weapons. And if they get into anything dicey, they just call the police to come help. And so it's really county by county what you're going to get. Even in some of the smaller counties, you'll have like a part-time dog warden who's also like the part-time janitor.
Does the bill address dog wardens at all, or is it mainly just the dogs?
It clarifies that the dog warden has power of arrest and power to enforce all of that section of the code.
Okay. Well, we'll keep updated on where that goes. This is All Sides in the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. And with me today, Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch, Noah Blundo with Hannah News Service, and Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press. I wanted to get an update on the higher education bill, also known as Senate Bill 1. It goes into effect officially this week, but there's also an effort to repeal it. Can someone give me an update on the signature gathering and what needs to happen in order to get that on the ballot?
Well, so under this sort of law, they have a until the effective date to mount a repeal of it. So the law is not yet in effect, but it's been passed. So there's this window. It's a pretty short window, 90 days, I guess, and they've been out trying to gather signatures that would ask voters, do you want this law in its entirety or do you not? And so it's just an up and down vote, and that's where they have the deadline. I believe it's Thursday.
Yeah, it's Thursday, and they need like 250,000 valid voter signatures with signatures collected in at least half of the 88 counties.
And this is to put it on the ballot for this coming November, right?
Yeah, it'll be the next general election. It'll be the first time since Senate Bill 5, the union
Yeah, so the Senate Bill 5, and that was like
2011.
11 went up for a referendum, and the voters said, no, thank you, we don't like this. Yeah. And it was a big repudiation of John Kasich's, you know, first big signature thing out of the gate. Mm. And then, of course, House Bill 6, they tried to put it up for a referendum, faced that big, well-funded counter campaign, and didn't collect enough signatures in time.
All right. Well, I guess we'll see this. Well, we won't find out this week. They have to turn them in, and then there's a whole process before we know if it made it, right?
I saw some reporting of one of the organizers, I think, with the Youngstown Faculty Union, saying he was cautiously optimistic
that they had enough.
We'll okay. have to see. I mean, there's usually a huge burn rate on these signatures. People often try to aim for double what they need because, you know, people sign it, but if they're not registered to vote or their registration's
not
updated,
or they sign it
updated,
a second time, or
lot of these signatures get thrown out.
And interestingly, there's a proposed election law right now that would say, well, a lot of times what people do now is, as I understand it, they will, as they're having people sign, they say, are you a registered voter? And if they say no, then they register them. So there's a little lag to get that person registered. And this bill would say that can't happen anymore. In the future, not for this one, but in the future, it would be you must be already registered to sign a petition. So keep an eye out for that. That would be a big change.
And this is unscientific, but I have been asked to sign that petition like at least a dozen times this summer as I've been out and about. And
they have a lot of people out there. Yeah,
yeah they do. Yeah,
I
have a personal policy and never sign any petitions.
Neither do I. They've been at the Whetstone Library every time I've been there in the past month.
All right. Well, one other topic I wanted to get to before we run out of time is Ohio lawmakers want to make America healthy again. This is echoing ideas that are happening at the federal level, but the state legislature is considering banning certain food dyes, restricting forever chemicals, and handing fluoride decisions to local officials. Laura, you wrote about this. Specifically, can Ohio, does this need to happen at the federal level, banning food dyes, or can Ohio do it locally here?
Oh, I think first off, this is part of, this is happening in multiple state legislatures where they're picking up on these Make America Healthy bills. And, banning, removing dyes or additives or forever chemicals. I do think that that's more of a federal question. One of the things in this one bill is making it permissive to local water departments on whether or not they want to add fluoride. It's been mandated since, I think, 1968 or 69 that fluoride be added for systems that serve at least 5,000 residents.
So letting each local water authority decide?
Yeah, if they want to, if Columbus decided they didn't want to add fluoride anymore, so be it. The bill sponsor said, you know, adding fluoride, it's designed to address the issue of tooth decay in children. But his point was, well, we also have a childhood obesity problem. Are we going to add weight loss drugs to our water?
There also is it a part of the same bill or the physical, they want to bring back the physical fitness test?
The presidential fitness test is a separate kind of Make America Healthy agenda item. When I was a kid, it was climb a rope to the top of the gym and run a mile. I had the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was incredibly unpopular.
I think Vivek Ramaswamy has also made some social media comments in favor of reinstating the presidential fitness test.
I thought you were about to say Vivek had actually won that. That award, because that's not that easy.
Fairly athletic.
I'd like to see him climb a rope before he says he wants to do it.
I'd like to see the lawmakers pass everybody who votes for that
has to climb the rope, has
to do the whole thing.
Yeah. Before we end, Julie, I wanted to congratulate you on being a finalist, along with your AP colleagues, for a Pulitzer Prize in breaking news coverage. It cited the Associated Press's reporting of the attempted assassination of President Trump in Pennsylvania last year. Congratulations on being a finalist.
Thank you very much.
So you were on the ground covering it in Butler County on the day that event happened. The Washington Post ended up winning for the prize for the same story. But you posted back in May that what it was like. You talked about what it was like to have your work singled out. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing because, you know, in the course of a 40-year career, the fact that just, you know, a Pennsylvania reporter happened to be on vacation and they said, can you drive over to Western PA and cover a political rally? Like, it just didn't ever strike me that it would be what it was, which was very, it was a very grueling, what turned out to be 4 days in Butler, Pennsylvania, without, you know, wearing clothes from the thrift store and trying to figure out the news.
Yeah, did you plan on being there just for one day, I guess,
just
right?
Actually, just for the afternoon and file my story. I was going to go to my sister's. But it is, it's really special because, our team really pulled together, and I think it took a village to kind of pull all that reporting. But I did learn how to go live and do a stand-up and turn in video and do interviews, and it was all in 100-degree heat, and so I'm pretty proud of it, so thank you.
Yeah, well, congratulations. What a great honor.
Julie's a rock star.
She's being very modest here, but Pulitzer Prize nominee, now you have that for your resume.
That's right. And Laura's husband actually made me a special hat, so...
All you need in life is a special hat. Yeah, you should be. I wish you were wearing it right now. Well, we're down to less than a minute left. Does anyone have anything in particular they're covering this week, or is it just all about the conference committee? What happens?
It's all about the conference committee, which meets at 3 p.m. on Tuesday. That's the advertised starting time, at least. Mm-hmm. We just got the notice minutes ago.
And we
usually
all know,
doesn't start on time.
Yeah, we all know ads are false.
Yeah.
I'm going to be covering J.D. Vance in Lima tomorrow. He's there for a fundraiser, but I guess it's open press, so we'll go see what he has to say about Iran and lots of other things.
All right. Well, thank you to Julie Carsmyth, government and politics reporter and Pulitzer Prize nominee for the Associated Press. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Laura.
Hey, thank you.
And Noah Blundo, executive editor at Hannah News Service. Thanks, Noah.
Thank you.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.